Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast and a very warm welcome if you're a first time listener. Now, our last episode was filled with the high octane fuel of capital P politics, was it not? Because the centre of that episode was an on-stage interview with Rishi Sunak, Chancellor of the Exchequer, conducted by Brian Glick, our editor-in-chief. And for the political podcast that I listen to, this is very much conference season. So it was Labour last week, the Conservatives this week. But it's also conference season for us tech journalists and, more importantly, for IT professionals. And in fact, we had our very own event last week, did we not? The Diversity and Inclusion in Tech Conference, co-hosted by Claire. That's done with Sphinx as well, though, isn't it, Claire? They get kind of co-billing for the event.
Yeah, they are our partners for the event. We found it a bit easier to do co-hosting while the event has been online. It's a little bit difficult to host an event when you feel like you're just talking to a computer screen. So it's nice to have someone to bounce off of. If it were in person, I probably would still be hosting it by myself.
Right.
But it's been really nice to have someone from Sphinx for the last two virtual years to just sort of help me out with it.
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought of that. Yeah, it went very well. And it sits alongside the publication of our list of the 50 most influential women in UK tech. But we'll discuss our own event at length shortly in this episode. Any thoughts, guys, on the IT conference scene this time around, this year's season?
I am trying to juggle lots of different virtual conferences at once this week in particular. And I've had to draw, like, I can't show you it at the minute and it would be rubbish for our listeners anyway because they couldn't see it. But I've had to draw up like a timetable for the whole of this week just to make sure, because it's so easy to miss stuff with it being a virtual conference. Like, you'll get in the zone writing something and you're like, oh no, I'm supposed to be at a keynote. You know, where's the URL for this session or that session? So yeah, I'm trying to get my head around everything and making sure I am where I'm supposed to be at each time, even though I'm sat in the same seat. So yeah, this week's going to be quite frantic, I think.
So Caroline, have you gone kind of old school with something on the wall there, like a chart?
Yeah,
like a crime investigation or something.
Yeah, I've got a little cork board in front of me that I put like my notes on. I write quite harsh reminders to myself, like, just make sure you do this week, because I am prone to forgetting to do things. So yeah, so now I need to have things written down and put physically in front of me rather than rather than getting just a little BP reminder from my computer saying you're supposed to be here. Like, so yeah, it doesn't always work for me.
Find that with even in-person conference season that there's so many activities and people to see and interesting things that you end up with just a really long to-do list and no time to write anything.
I think as well, like, if these were all in-person conferences, there would be some of them I'd just RSVP to and say no, I can't do that because I'm at another conference that day. But because they're all virtual, you do feel like, oh well, you know, I've got like half an hour between this thing and that thing, so I guess I can go to both conferences. Whereas, you know, if you think in-person ones, it'd probably be like, oh, you've got to get from Olympia to XL in like half an hour if you want to meet both, like go to both these conferences or both these shows. So what I'm saying is I'm just probably busier than normal in a normal like pre-pandemic conference season at the moment.
Yeah, they're a really good filter, aren't they, kind of real world conferences, because you can't be in two places at once, so you're just focused on one thing rather than all the other events that are going on simultaneously, and that's kind of been taken away from us a bit. I think there's a lot of pluses to virtual conferences as well, but I think this year it's been a bit, everyone's been a little bit kind of second time around of doing virtual conferences, maybe a little bit fatigued. You can even see it in some of the CEOs are like, don't really want to be here anymore. This is taking up 15 minutes of my time and, you know, I'm not having fun, because they love being the centre of attention, don't they? And it's not the same.
Have you got any in-person ones?
Well, I'm still looking for Oracle Open World. I meant to check before coming on the podcast. There was a fairly anemic Salesforce conference a couple of weeks back. I mean, it was okay, but it wasn't, anything like the real Dreamforce. And I think Mark Benioff would probably much rather be doing it in person. Same with Anil Bhusri of Workday. He seemed a bit down in the dumps to me, just my impression at their event last week or the week before, can't quite remember. It just seems like we're a bit in limbo because it's neither one thing nor the other at the minute. But anyway, as with a lot of things, that will get resolved. So this episode, just to say where we're going, first we've got Claire's segment. Claire, have you recovered?
Just about. I could probably do with another day to sleep, but we can't have everything that we want.
No, we can't have everything that we want. But I'm more in the event and the list very soon. And then, so connected with the theme of diversity, I'm going to say a few things about an initiative from Newham Borough Council in East London to fire up a data economy. Newham's one of the most diverse boroughs in London, which of course is a very diverse city in any case. So there's a bit of a link there. And I'll also mention artificial intelligence in my bit. But AI looms large, indeed spreads its wings in your segment, Caroline.
Yeah, I got wind of a story about a wind power farm and how some project Microsoft's doing to make sure that this wind farm's activities don't negatively impact on the local puffin population of the Isle of May.
More on that towards the end of the podcast. I'm not saying it's an Anne Finley.
But it's an animal story, so it pretty much is, yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. We're going to begin with Claire. So this year's event, Claire, how did it feel to you?
That's a really difficult question. So it's both less and more stressful than in-person events. So the difference between the two being that a lot of the time I spend the entire day in-person events thinking, please, please, please let all of my keynotes show up. Whereas with the online events, a majority of the keynotes have been pre-recorded and then sent in, which obviously sort of takes that pressure off a little bit. But then you have possibility of technical difficulties. Mm-hmm. They're both stressful. But, diversity is important. So
did it feel kind of more, better than last year? You're more in the flow of it. It was a 10th edition as well, wasn't it, of the list?
It was. So it's the 10th year that we've run the list of the top 50 women in UK tech. When it was originally launched, it was a list of the top 25 women. And since then, it's grown to be 50, and we've added a rising stars list and a Hall of Fame list as well, just to get as many women showcased as possible, basically. I know I say this every year, and every year it's also, disappointing that we have to keep talking about it and pushing it and then watch the numbers not change, which is something that was addressed at the event.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I attended some of it. What's that figure? Is it something like 15%, 12 to 15?
Between 15 and 17% of IT professionals in the UK are women. I think that's the percentage. Right. And it sort of like bounces around there and doesn't move much beyond that.
And it doesn't really, it's not seeming to budge very much. But I know during the one of the panel things you asked your panel about what's changed in the past 10 years, has there been any progress and things like that?
Did I?
Yeah, you did. I was there.
Sometimes these things just run away from me and I come away from it thinking, did I speak for that whole time? There has been a lot of positive progress made. If not in the numbers, then in attitudes. And, there are a lot of initiatives, there are a lot of people on board, there are a lot more visible and accessible role models in the industry, I would say. And we'll have a video of that panel on Computer Weekly later, so you can check out what I actually did say when I chaired the panel.
Did you ask that question? Yeah.
It's such a whirlwind. You just sort of get on with it.
I was going to ask, is it like sometimes when I'm driving my car and then I've gone somewhere and then I'm like, I don't remember any of the route. I don't know. Do I stop at any traffic? Like, is it that kind of thing where you're just like, I don't know what's happened?
Yeah, it is like that. The driving amnesia.
Andrea Palmer, I was really good on things like that. I thought in one of your panels, chair of BCS Women. I mean, she's number four on the list this year. Yeah, she was really cool, down to earth, and she did say, well, at least there is more kind of diversity training and stuff than there used to be, and so on.
Unconscious bias training, I think she mentioned specifically, yeah. And then we had a bit of a discussion about that and how we move that forward as something that companies can offer to employees. But Andrea is amazing, and she has previously been a judge of the list. So a new person appeared on behalf of BCS this year as a judge. So it's the first time that she's been able to be put forward for the list, because it would have been unethical for someone who was judging it to also appear.
Yeah, and Andrea and Rushaw were both kind of very impassioned about saying, come on, guys, you know, get your act together here. Why aren't you male IT directors and CIOs doing more? You know, we've been talking about this for long enough. That was one of the things that I remembered anyway from. And a key theme was allyship. That came through very strongly.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that people higher up in organizations can help with. I think the message behind it is that people who are higher up in organizations are in a better position to help to push through diversity and inclusion with things like hiring practices and internal groups and et cetera, et cetera. It just so happens that those people are in a majority white men. So it's not like saying, oh, men are the problem and they need to help. It's, you know, people higher up in organizations need to be more involved in this. Most of those people are white men.
So she was number four. Who was number one this year, Claire?
So our winner was the CEO of Darktrace, Poppy Gustafsson. She's brilliant. And she's really friendly. There's a interview that I did with her in the lead up to the event on just what she's doing at Darktrace and how she got where she is and what she thinks about the state of diversity and inclusion in tech. Really interesting, if I do say so myself, because obviously I wrote it. But
I read that. There was something really interesting in it that sort of jumped out at me. It was about the part where she was saying that she didn't realise, well, she didn't notice like necessarily that the, because she's a mathematics graduate, isn't she, that sort of the field she went into, she didn't realise until she got to university, oh, this is a male-dominated field, like, where's all the women? And it's just, I just thought it was really interesting, because like, some of the times when we've talked about diversity on the podcast, one of the recurring things is like, you know, young girls sort of put off going into certain careers because they are sort of renowned for being male-dominated. And it's the fact, I quite like this idea, you know, just knuckled down, was doing our work, and then, oh, hell, hold a minute, where's all the women? Like, and it's, yeah.
I mean, I experienced a bit of that myself as well, but then I went to a female only school, so there were no men in the class. but then obviously at university I was like, oh wow, we sure are outnumbered, aren't we, ladies?
No, it is a really good interview, really.
Yeah, no, it is a really good interview. Darktrace, so that's AI-enabled cybersecurity.
Yep, that's the one.
Clever stuff. Yeah, and their employee base is like 30 to 40% women, isn't it? I wonder how they did that.
I said that's quite an unusual figure. And she said, you know, we tried to hire the best people for the job. We weren't really aiming for, you know, like a diverse mix or whatever. But I said, you must be doing something, though, different, because I'm sure that a lot of other firms would argue the same, that, you know, so.
That's interesting, though, because we spoke about the A-level results earlier in another podcast, and how it's like, this, I think it's the first time that young women have outperformed young men in A-level maths this year. So yeah, maybe if you do just continue hiring the best people for the job, then you'll find that, hey, things are getting a bit better here.
But if you have 10 men you hire the best people for the job. If you have five men and five women and you hire the best person for the job, it's the pool that you are hiring from still needs to be diverse, even if you then pick the best person from that pool.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I sometimes wonder if part of the answer here is just to employ and get into tech jobs and tech roles, both in, you know, user organizations and in tech firms, just more people who do non-STEM degrees. So people from liberal arts backgrounds, politics, history, English, you know, philosophy, whatever. Just more people like that, because more women tend to do those subjects. So you will end up with a kind of filter coming through, because you don't need to have a computer science degree to work in tech or to manage like an SAP project in a company. In fact, you know, many people who do that sort of thing don't have STEM degrees, even let alone computer science. But I don't know if that gets raised very much.
I think there are two things about that as well. A lot of companies are relying on technology more and more. So you could argue that there are a lot of technology roles in non-tech companies, and some of those companies, depending on what they do, might be more appealing to underrepresented groups. And then also what a company's hiring policy is. So a lot of companies won't hire people unless they have a degree, not necessarily a technology degree, but a degree in something, which isn't always relevant, I personally don't think. But then I'm not a hiring manager, so what do I know?
Anything you would highlight from the list this year, Claire? Maybe rising stars or anything you'd pick out? I know it's a bit of a invidious question, since you've got, you know, it's a bit like asking what's your favorite child, but anything you pick out?
Well, I will say that because it's the 10th year of the top 50 list, we added 10 people to our Hall of Fame and 10 people to our Rising Stars this year. So even more people being represented and showcased for the great work that they're doing. So I would definitely go and have a little read through and see if anybody you know's on there, and if there's anybody that you think should have been on there that isn't, make sure that you nominate them next year.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll obviously have links to all the material concerning both the event and the list and the summary article that goes with the podcast. Claire, a grand job as ever. So the topic of diversity is one way, it's not the only way, but it's one way into the story that I've chosen to talk about today. And this is a story about the London Borough of Newham in the east end of the capital. Now there was a lot of kind of building and regeneration there about 10 plus years ago because of the Olympics coming to London. And that did create a lot of jobs, mostly in retail and construction, maybe with quite a lot of 0 hours contracts and things like that. But now the council, led by Roxana Fiaz, the mayor, she wants to create more of a data economy in the borough. And her advisor for that, kind of working with her, is a guy called Omid Shiraji, who actually we've interviewed a few times in Computer Weekly in various CIO roles. His job title for this is Newham Sparks Strategic Advisor to the Mayor of Newham, a grand title. And that's because the name of the initiative they've got is Newham Sparks, that's what it's called. And I interviewed him along with the mayor a couple of weeks in advance of the launch of this, which was done at London Tech Week on the 22nd of September, in fact. But the aim of Newham Sparks, and this is their, you know, this is their story, is that they want to create what they're going to call a data corridor of economic activity in the borough. I think geographically running from the Royal Docks, you know, that enterprise zone to the Olympic Park area around Stratford. I think that's what, you know, physically what they've got in mind. But the main idea here, and I think it's just really cool. So they have a very young, very digitally savvy population. Almost 40% are under 24. And as you both know really well, and Claire, especially you, that generation after generation of young people in Newham Tower Hamlets as well, actually, East End of London generally. I've been getting some of the best GCSE and A-level results in the country. And yet, the population is, the majority of the population, Roxana was telling me, live in poverty, like official poverty statistics and stuff. It's a very diverse borough, as I said, 70% Black or other minority ethnic community people, 242 languages spoken, she told me. That's an amazing amount of languages in a relatively small geographical area. And as I said, the initiative was launched during London Tech Week. It's a stake in the ground thing, it seems to me, just now. They're just saying, this is our idea, come and talk to us. They're looking for investors. They want to build actual data centers, physical data centers. They seem to be working on this with University College London, because UCL has got this UCL East campus, and Tower Hamlets Council as well, also in the East End. And they said they keep us up to date with it. And Roxana Fias has invited Computer Weekly to come and see what they're doing and what they'll be doing in the future, etc. So I don't know. I think it's a cool idea to kind of join together, this population, very young, digitally savvy population, and try and create some knowledge-based jobs that will be sustainable for the future, not just retail and construction and whatnot and 0 hours contracts jobs, but jobs that will last. I don't know what, I mean, you're both much more Londoners than I am. I mean, how does this resonate with you?
After the Olympics, it's like, this will bring, the legacy of the Olympics means this part of London will thrive for years to come and everything. And there wasn't really much, I never felt like there was much detail. I'm like, oh, well, how? What, just because
you
had the Olympics once, that's just going to make people want to work here? Like, what's the thing? So, no, it's quite nice to hear that there's an actual, it seems like someone's actually pulling together a strategy, an actual long-term plan for how to rejuvenate the area and the economy in, or give it a lifeline in like a way that is, tapping in very much into the way the world is moving, our increasingly digitized economy. And anyone who wants to build new data centers or more data centers gets, like, my vote. I would say that's a winning thing to do.
Did you not say to me before, Caroline, that somebody did propose like building a data center somewhere?
Yeah, I think it was the old Olympic media center. It was being kind of marketed. It's definitely 1 year I went to Data Center World, the UK's premier data center show in Excel. And I had like a couple of interviews with people who were like, oh yeah, we're trying to market this facility. We're going to get like a hyperscaler in there and they're just going to take up all this space and it's going to be amazing. And then for whatever reason, that sales pitch didn't quite land and they ended up selling that site to the V&A Museum, I believe. Just because although it would have worked fine as a data center, I think in terms of trying to market a site like that to like an Amazon Web Services or Microsoft or Google or someone, it's quite an isolated from memory. I think it's quite an isolated sort of data center just on its own. Whereas they usually like to move into somewhere they know they can expand into, sort of build more data centers or create a campus and things like that. So I think for that reason, the way they were approaching it didn't quite fit. I think it was still at the time quite an attitude of like, the big hyperscalers, they need data centers. We've got a data center. They'll just have it. The whole, if you build them, they will come. That's not strictly true. So yeah, I think that kind of fell by the wayside a bit, but there's nothing to say that someone else having another go at it or, data center in that area couldn't thrive.
Yeah. Like I said, at the moment, it does seem to be a kind of an aspiration, a stake in the ground. They had this event at London Tech Week. We'll see how it goes. I mean, she strikes me as a very charismatic politician and very kind of cool and stuff. And Omid seems really, really switched on and thinking strategically about creating a kind of, I hate the word ecosystem, but, that sort of thing. And they very much want to focus on data, not just kind of digital or IT more generally. And a big, big policy point that both of them said is we don't want this to be like Silicon Valley, trickle down, you know, you have all this tech and tech workers, but you have an impoverished population living around there. They don't want it to be trickled down. They want it to be kind of bottom up and so on, which, you know, is obviously very, very kind of laudable. It's early days, though. It's early days. She told me a story about some young lad that had been involved in a gang or, you know, gang culture and knew him. Saying that he'd had a kind of moment of epiphany in his tower block looking across at Canary Wharf, because you can see Canary Wharf, and thinking, well, why can't I have some of that? And she was saying, well, you know, if we don't provide these kind of jobs for generations of young people, then a lot of them do look to crime.
It's not just about providing the jobs, though. It's about providing the path to jobs. And like you said, quite a lot of the people who live in Newham might be, you know, like from poorer backgrounds. But if they're given the opportunity, so for example, do they have the technology to be doing their homework at home? Do they have the technology at home to be able to, you know, learn more about data and data science and data analytics? If they're given that opportunity at school, for example, and if schools are on board with the program, then that's a completely different story. But jobs, like roles, doesn't equal jobs.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the vision is, you know, it's connecting all those things up and working with educational, I mean, it is a council, right? So schools and it's especially seems to be UCL with this UCL East campus. So yeah, there is a kind of joined up thing there.
Yeah, but again, that's university level, isn't it?
Yeah, that is, yeah.
Yeah, so if that's university level and then they're expecting them to go into jobs in that local area, is there anywhere for them to live? In and around the area, like, because the whole problem with Silicon Valley is that you've got, you know, luxury apartments where people are expected to work 24/7 and they have everything there for them and they don't really need to go outside and then actually interact with people who live in that area who are likely to be from a different socioeconomic background. So are you just creating the same problem?
No, they're trying to deliberately not doing that. So they deliberately don't want that. She mentioned Barclays Homes. Apparently there's going to be some big Barclays Home development in this area, 5,000 homes, I think. Oh, my memory's beginning to fade on this, but I think they're quite holistic in their approach. But you know me, I mean, I like to believe things, don't I? So you should be a bit more skeptical about
You definitely should, because who are those homes for? The people who have the jobs, not the people who, you know, like currently live in the area. So is this like a gentrification effort, and the people who actually live there and have grown up there their whole lives?
It's absolutely.
So how are they affording these houses?
She comes from the area.
Okay.
She was born there.
Does she live there?
Yeah.
Okay. In a nice neighborhood?
I've not been to her house.
Okay.
She's really cool. You'd like her, Claire.
Okay.
I think you would like
her. I'll have to look her up on the Wikipedia.
We'll see how it goes. Time will tell. So at their launch event, which for full disclosure, I didn't attend their launch event because I had a hospital appointment. It was perfectly.
That's fine.
Which is why I interviewed them in advance. But apparently they had an exhibition with augmented reality, virtual reality technologies, Internet of Things stuff, and robotics. I did wonder about that, given the big emphasis they were putting on data as such. And I've seen a photo of Roxana with, what's that robot? Is it Pepper? You know, that kind of generic robot thing. But I mean, robots are quite photogenic, aren't they? So I think they will want to have some AI in there as well, feeding off the data. So like I said, artificial intelligence is one of the technology areas that Neom Sparks wants to be involved in. But let's face it, I mean, there is a lot of puff in the area of AI. A lot of small companies puffing themselves up with their rhetoric. So I think it's time to turn to some actual puffins.
I think that might be the worst link you've ever done, Brian. I think, and this is like scraping the barrel anyway, but yeah.
Good effort, good effort.
Yeah, I have to confess, I was drawn to writing this story just on the promise of the accompanying photography that the Microsoft's PR first offered up when they got in touch about it. And if you check the story out on Computer Weekly, I think we can all agree it's got one of the cutest article images we've probably had in a very long time on the site. It's basically two puffins sort of touching beaks. So if nothing else, just go and look at it for the pictures. But yeah, they do say a picture paints a thousand words, and that story is about 1,000 words long, so I'll probably get on and talk about it rather than talk about how great the pictures that went alongside it were. So finding ways to decarbonize the economy is something government policymakers all over the world are looking to do at the moment. And one way they're looking to do that is through getting countries to ramp up their use of renewable power. And Brian's homeland of Scotland is no different in that regard. The country is renowned for having some of the most ambitious renewable energy usage targets in the world, having pledged in 2011, so over 10 years ago, to have 100% of its electricity demand met by green power by 2020. Unfortunately, it missed the target, only by a couple of percentage points though, so it's not too bad. But undeterred, they're carrying on, and they're working to get more of their sort of national grid powered by green power. What I found out with this story is you can't just whack up like a wind farm or a solar farm just anywhere. You have to apparently have to do your research and make sure you're putting it somewhere proper. And one thing they have to do with these kind of projects as well is make sure that, you know, for example, if you're going to put, say, a wind farm in the middle of the sea, you've got to make sure that that location, having that there, doesn't have a negative impact on kind of native wildlife or, you know, the environment in general. Because it's one thing to sort of, hey, this is a really good thing for the environment to have green power and let's not use fossil fuels. But if you're killing off a population of puffins in this case to do so, it's probably not the best. So what they've done is they have, there's a company called SSE Renewables, who are a green power firm. And they've got an 84-turbine offshore wind farm in the north of Scotland. And apparently that creates enough power to power 455,000 homes, I found out. So basically this, to make sure that this wind farm doesn't have any adverse effects on the local puffin population, they basically send out these people. And I don't know what their official job title is. I'm just going to call them puffin counters. So there's a place called the Isle of May, which is apparent, again, I keep saying apparently, I don't mean to sound as skeptical as I do, and I apologise for that. So on the Isle of May, it is home to, I think it is the third largest puffin colony in the UK. So it's someone's job, one of these puffin counters, to go around and sort of manually check in on the puffins from time to time. They've got to count how many puffins there are, but also count how many eggs that they've laid during the breeding season. So they usually land on the island sort of late March, so sort of springtime until about August. And in that time, they are basically breeding. So they come home to roost and, you know, get on with things, basically. So a puffin counter is deployed to the island to go around and count, like say, eggs and puffins. And it sounds like a pretty sweet gig, actually. Apparently it can be very physically demanding work. Probably not a barrel of laughs for the puffins either. You know, if you think about it, if you're a puffin, you're minding your own business, just doing your puffin thing, maybe, you know, getting it on a little bit, because that, you know, it is mid-March to mid-August. And then somebody turns up unannounced wanting to inspect your living quarters. I mean, you'd be mortified, wouldn't you? You wouldn't like it.
Mm-hmm. It's a fun time of the year, that whole time.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want any unannounced guests, do you?
No. Sorry, Caroline, where are they the rest of the time then? Puffins.
I try not to intrude too much on the privacy of puffins. I just let them get on with whatever they want to do. It's just, see, I don't know. I guess out to sea, just hanging around doing puffin stuff. So SSE Renewables, the green power firm, they've teamed up with Microsoft and one of its partners called Avanade on this project that uses cameras and combines them with AI tech to identify and count puffins instead. So you don't need people to go to the island. It can all be done through cameras and AI. So they're basically removing humans from the equation and reducing the amount of manual handling that goes on with the puffins. But probably my favorite bit of the project, which I won't go into too much detail about because that's why I wrote about it. Probably my favorite bit of the project is the fact that they had an AI-based image recognition tool that had to be trained to, you know, work out what's a puffin and what's not. So it's like, is this a seagull or is it a puffin? Oh, it's a puffin. Is that a rock or is it a puffin? So they've had to train this thing so it makes sure it 100% knows what a puffin is, but also make sure it hasn't counted the same puffin twice. I don't know how you even do that, because all puffins look the same to me, but I guess, you know, if I was a trained puffin counter, I'd know, no, that one's Jeff and that one's Mike. You can't, you know, they're two totally different puffins. So yeah, so that's something that did, I was like, wow, just how do you do that?
God, that is so demanding, isn't it?
Oh. Yeah.
I'm just imagining, you know, like a guy holding up a set of pictures in front of this robot and being like, new puffin, different puffin. Like, is it the same puffin?
It's the same puffin.
It's Mike, goddammit, it's Mike. We've already seen Mike.
Well, there's only one puffin on the island now.
Yeah, it's like there's an episode of Father Ted back in the day where they had Chris the sheep, and they're like, oh, these sheep, and they were comparing two pictures of sheep that look completely identical. That, oh, it's staggering, they look so different. It is basically the same sheep. So I think it's just that kind of, that's what it put me in the mind of as I was writing it. But there is another bit to this project which they didn't really go into enough, but is something I'm very interested in, is the fact, like I said, there's the AI training bit to it, but also the camera. So the camera has a live feed of Puffin Island, like just what are the puffins up to all day. Yeah. And I mean, like, so we've already said the whole reason that they're there is for breeding purposes. So you've got a live camera feed of what's going on. I mean, Brian, you don't need Love Island anymore. If you could get that onto your Amazon Fire Stick, however you choose to watch your TV at home, that, yeah, Puffin Love Island. How much?
I was wondering if the cameras were online, whether you could watch the puffins from wherever you are.
Well, there wouldn't be much point in the minute because they've all gone out to sea again. But
it was partly
come springtime.
Yeah, but from March to August then.
Yeah, so that is basically the project in a nutshell. What the hope is because at the moment, like I say, if you're sending people out to do this work, it obviously, like I say, it's very manual. It takes a long time, and so it's hoped that by sort of removing humans from this from the equation and being able to just kind of get. Like a sort of instant snapshot of just how many puffins are here, what are they doing, are they healthy, is our wind farm negatively affecting them, yes or no. I think their hope is that in future this will speed up the time it takes to bring new sort of green projects online, new sort of wind farm projects, sorry, and things like that, because you won't have to have so much human intervention.
I'm imagining this post-apocalyptic future where there are no humans left, but the AI is still counting puffins. Like, the puffins are good, but there's no human overlord to tell.
Yeah, you train me to do one job, I'm going to keep doing it as long as there's puffins. That's a puffin, that's not a puffin. That's a puffin, number two. Yeah,
it's the same puffin.
Yeah, that's same Mike, boy. That's Jeff. Yeah. So it's all good. But yeah, I enjoy writing stories about climate change tech and sustainability and stuff, but when there's an animal factor involved as well, it's even better. So I didn't go into too much detail on the actual tech because you can read that in the case study itself, but I think though, not that it is a competition, but it is a competition. I think I am definitely in the lead in terms of the number of stories this year that have featured animals on Computer Weekly.
Are you?
I had one with a lobster that was in the article image.
You did.
I had another one about a trout farm. So I didn't tell anyone that, you know, that this was a competition, but if you want to catch up, you're gonna have to get some stories in, guys.
I haven't got a lot of time.
No, but yeah, there you go. The gauntlet is down.
Well, one of my little jobs on Computer Weekly is to compile the news digest and the e-zine, and there's always a couple of picture stories there, and I always make sure that I get Caroline's animal stories into the issue. And this story was certainly a marvelous opportunity to get a picture of a puffin into the Computer Weekly e-zine. I would have put it on the front cover.
But then you'd be booting the women off.
Yeah. Sorry, ladies.
No, well, we had in that issue we had Rishi Sunak.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say, like, they're both kind of endangered species. They're very, puffins and women in the tech industry. So similar vibe, really.
Yeah, no, that was Rishi's issue. he was on the front cover.
Well, Next year we can have the top 50 puffins in UK IT. And we'll get the AI to source all of the pictures and make sure it's not the same puffin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would we get the AI to do the judging of the puffins?
Oh, that's a good question. We'll have to talk to Microsoft about it.
Yeah. Hall of Fame puffins, that'd be good after a while too. I could see, yeah, it's got legs.
So we'll link to Caroline's delightful puffin story in the article that goes with the podcast and all the other stories we've spoken about in the episode. And very importantly, the list and Claire's interview with Poppy Gustafson from Darktrace. You can read those and listen to the podcast as well on computerweekly.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. Sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this time round. And so it just remains for me to say, as always and ever, thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you so much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening to us. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.